when we talk about finding a voice, I mean, I don't really, it sometimes it sounds pretentious, I think, but to me it's just like a very simple act of self-expression. This is like, I feel comfortable saying this, and I feel an emotion saying this. And I think that one of the rewarding parts of like listening to your own performances, like when you go into the studio and you, after some time, you press play and you have, you if you can be at peace with what you're hearing, and you can be, that this is the emotion that I was trying to express. It's just like the very basic artistic expression that really comes from like 30,000 years ago when we were playing a flute in a cave, you know?
Hi, this is Dave Douglas, and this is the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. And that was the voice and music of Alexis Cuadrado. Alexis is originally from Spain, and we talked about his musical migration both to New York and into composition and production. In addition to many other things, Alexis writes music for podcasts, and we talk about the new medium and how it works. In the extra, we go more into his thoughts on podcast world and all the ins and outs. Some great music in this episode and some solid wisdom from Alexis. And as always, you can email me and you can support the Greenleaf Music community at greenleafmusic.com. So come and join us and enjoy the interview. Thanks.
The eye seeking home has to lower, lower, lower. Lower. The eye seeking home has to lower. The eye seeking home has to lower. Lower, lower, lower. The eye seeking home has to lower. The eye seeking home has to lower, 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 lower. The eye seeking home has to lower. There are no towers.
Alexis Cuadrado, welcome.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Oh, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You're originally from Barcelona.
I am born and raised in Barcelona.
Catalan. And we just heard this song, Song of Fulton and Gold, and I'd imagine that that calls back to some of your early music influences. But also there's a poem, there's a lyric
right.
that's in English.
Right. Well, it's part of an album called Poetica. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the main theme of that album is the feeling of almost like cultural dislocation. It's like, where do you belong? Mm. Where are you from? And where do you live? You know, and how those ideas marry. And it was a collaboration with two poets, an American poet called named Rowan Ricardo Phillips, whose poem "Song of Fulton and Gold" is, and a Catalan poet named Melcion Mateo. And they're amazing. I mean, they're incredible writers and really open-minded people. And the idea was to, you know, I am a Catalan Spanish person living in New York. Rowan is an American poet married to a Catalan Spanish woman who has a really strong tie with the American, with Catalan culture. And he's also from the Caribbean. So there's all this kind of like cross-cultural thing. And in a way, we are in New York and we feel like New York is our hub.
Yeah.
It's the place where we sort of like stay and we kind of belong here, but you never have a feeling that you fully belong.
But it's a meeting point where all these things can coexist.
That's right.
In a way that maybe they can't elsewhere.
That's right.
Do you feel like maybe that's why you came to New York?
Absolutely. Yeah. Huh. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking to someone a couple of days ago and, I said, like, I think that I had country dysphoria in the sense that I didn't believe, I did never belonged to that place.
Oh, I thought you meant like country music.
No, country, like, no, like location, no, location. So, and this is something that you don't really realize. I mean, I love Barcelona, I love Catalonia, I love Spain, I love Europe.
Me too.
And it's a great place. However, I am not sure that I could fully realize and feel completely comfortable there. I feel more comfortable living in the U.S.
But do you
than
think,
there.
I mean, and this is that an observation, this dysphoria, you know, after having lived here? Or do you feel like you already experienced that before you even came?
I think in hindsight, I was experiencing that, but I didn't know I was experiencing it.
Because you did, I mean, you went to Taller de Musique.
That's right.
in Barcelona. Yes. So, but you were playing jazz.
Yes.
You're primarily a bass player, would you say?
Yes.
Acoustic bass. So
I did
having
all school
learned,
electric though.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I've seen you play electric.
Yeah.
And, but I guess, you know, to go back to the dysphoria and growing up in Spain, you must have been attracted to American jazz at
Absolutely.
Some level.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of people in Barcelona who,
yes,
come out of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was obsessed. I was, I was ill with
who?
Music. I mean, everything. My in that regard, growing up in Barcelona was a strange thing because as a kid, I was really exposed to basically two things: MTV in the 80s, and then what was around traditionally, which it was either very traditional Catalan music, which I've never been really interested in.
Like Sardanyas?
Or kind of stuff. Like, you know, or like more the flamenco stuff that my mom's from the south of Spain. Mm-hmm. We would go visit family in the south. I remember going to a flamenco mass, to Semana Santa and seeing all that. And not really liking it, but it was there.
Yeah.
You know, even when I was a student at the Taller, you know, there is a flamenco area where, you know, I could see Enrique Morente and Maite Martin and incredible musicians, and you would have lunch with them.
Wow.
So that was there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for me, like, American music was always like super important, you know, like, and English
not
music,
just
British
the MTV,
pop. I mean,
not just the MTV bit. Though,
initially, as a teenager, yes. Then as I grew up, my entry to jazz was a couple of three things, I would say. Listening to Miles Davis's Decoy.
Okay.
And like that bass, like Daryl Jones playing all that slap bass, that kind of blew my mind. And then seeing Carlos Benavent play and meeting him. And
great
and then
Catalan bass player.
Yeah, incredible. And then discovering Jaco Pastorius. And that was like, okay, this is what I'm doing.
Wow.
That's what I want to do. So my entry point to jazz was more like through this like a more like electric fusion kind of style. And then it just started going backward as I was going to school. And I feel like I'm still going back. By now I'm like at Palestrina or something like that.
I guess you have a relatively long way to go, depending on how you look at it. Wow, that's interesting. So because I hear a lot of these influences, your music, the flamenco, and the I don't know if I would be able to identify a Catalan sound in the influence, but all kinds of jazz and different Latin musics, right? And and I'm sure that a lot of things developed for you after you got to New York.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it was it's almost like I had to go through all these phases growing up as a musician. First, just play. I played a lot of crazy gigs in Spain. I played gypsy weddings that were 24 hours long with gypsy musicians.
Wow.
I used to play in like, you know, what they call pachanga there, which is like fiesta band.
Right.
So it's like whatever popular party on the street.
Yep.
I did a summer tour with a band like that in a van where we would play three times 2 hour sets a night, every night for 2 months.
Amazing. Oh God.
Yeah. It was the real deal. That's like going to the army. That's going to the music army. So you learn to play your instrument on the stage. And I was 20 years old. I mean, it was the best thing that I ever did. And I hated it at the moment. I was just doing it for the money, to be able to go to school.
Right.
But it was an amazing experience. I mean, I've been thrown cans on stage.
Like,
people get drunk and go crazy. Anyway, and then...
I still get cans thrown at me, but...
Anyway,
but you know that I spent a year in Spain when
I
was around 15, 16.
That's right.
And did a summer of that kind of, not as intense as what you're talking about.
Right.
Pachanga and some of these gigs with David Chirgu and a lot of other folks that are still on the scene there.
That's right.
So,
I mean, and you learn by doing. And the point is like, I had to go through that phase while I was going through music school.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I focused on the double bass for a few years. I was studying with this incredible player, performer, Francois Rabat, in Paris. I was commuting to Paris.
Amazing.
And then I moved to New York. And when I moved to New York, I think my quote-unquote jazz identity was pretty much solid. And especially the last couple of years I was in Barcelona, I was able to play with a lot of New York musicians. Thank you, Jorge Rossi, for like... connecting me with a lot of people. Like Jorge was going back and forth at that time. And
what year did you move here?
99. So this is my 20th year.
Wow.
Yeah. August of 1999. So almost 20 years.
That's great. Jorge is an amazing musician.
I know. Yeah. And I was very lucky. Like he probably saw that I was really hungry and I really working hard to just get better and get into it. And I was passionate about it. And he just started calling me for gigs. Suddenly I was like playing with Ben Munder and Seamus Blake and Kurt Rosenwinkel without really being ready. But you're never ready for anything in life.
You're never ready.
It's just like, so you just got to jump in and do it.
You might as well just do it.
Yep. So,
and then you figure out what you need to do to get ready.
That's right. Yeah. I remember the first time playing with Ben Munder, I was terrified because by the second chorus of a blues, I had no idea what was going on. It's like, okay, this is good. I'm going to have to work hard here somewhat and figuring stuff out. So
it sounds so great.
And then a couple of years later, I'm
thrown off
the
deep end.
Yes.
Yeah. You moved to New York and you know, to get back to some of your music. I mean, you know, you have a whole career as a producer now and of course a recording artist putting out your own records on Sunnyside and other labels. But you have this thing that you do that I find really interesting and new in the field, which is writing music for podcasts.
Right. It's been a lot of podcasts, some film.
Film scoring. You know, we'll get to you. You have a collaboration with Dance as well.
Right.
You know, all of this is wonderful, but podcast being such a new, to put down anything else, but podcast being such a new medium, and I, you know, I love podcasts, and I have one, and here we are, but I just thought that your process of setting up atmospheres for these situations is such a unique opportunity, and you do it so well.
Oh, thank you.
And of course, it comes out of everything that you've done.
Right.
But there's also this production aspect that I think
is really
important for you.
And it's been like learning a new instrument, to be honest with you. The whole production thing, it's really been, how do I make this work? Or in a way, when you're learning composition, right? Like, I remember attending that workshop with you a few years ago, and it's a lot of questions that you have to ask yourself. And then, again, you may not know the answer, but you kind of have a vision of what that final goal is. So this has been a lot of learning by doing and a lot of like self-training. Luckily, everything is online today. You can learn all the techniques for everything on videos and or whatever, and it depends on how you learn it. And now it's like, okay, this is the tool that I need. I see it as tools that I need to do that. But to answer your question, I see production as another instrument. I see it as another way of expression, as the same way that an instrument itself is, or this composition is. So it's another part of my voice in a way that I'm trying to develop.
I became aware of this because I started listening to this podcast called The Slowdown, which is every weekday, I believe.
Right.
And it's Tracy K. Smith, U.S. Poet Laureate,
that's right,
talking about poems. And then she reads a poem in every episode. And then I learned that it's your music that's supporting it. So I just want to play like the first bit of one of these episodes just to give people a sense what this sounds like.
Great.
I'm U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, and this is The Slowdown. One day, when I was still a teenager, I felt my heart fill up with something I'd never felt before. It was an exquisite feeling. A hurricane of emotion.
So that's from The Slowdown, and that's Tracy K. Smith's voice, and we thank her a lot for allowing us to use it in this episode, and also for having you as the composer for the episodes. They're so strong. I can imagine that creating something with enough feeling but also transparency to allow whatever elements she's going to bring into the episode to coexist with your music is a big part of the challenge.
Right. I got to say, this was, in a way, one of the shows that I've done that gave me the most freedom to do whatever I wanted. I mean, they gave me like three references. I always ask for references to the producers. It's like, what would you like to hear?
Will you tell us what the references were?
Sure, I will. Was John Coltrane, Ascension? Mm-hmm. And then she said, I love Guillermo Klein. Just do something that sounds like Guillermo Klein and that has a meter change.
Huh.
She said that. I mean, I never talked to Tracy. I've never met her, actually. I always talk to the producer.
Uh-huh.
But I was like, well, of course, I love Guillermo Klein and
John Coltrane's Ascension is not bad either.
And there was something else. I think it was like, was it Pharoah Sanders or something in that vein? So they wanted something very atmospheric,
open,
in a way.
But open, modal.
You know, but also I think they wanted this more angular, more modern, edgy, kind of metrically involved music. And they wanted the horns. So, for example, I got my friend Jay Rodriguez to do all the horns.
Wow.
And I wrote it. I wrote the arrangements. And, you know, I got to his house and he has a little recording rig. And we just like tracked it, overdubbing everything.
Great.
Yeah.
But everything else you record at home. Right?
I record at home and I try to, I mean, there's definitely some MIDI instruments, which these days are very good samples, very good quality. And I try to always use a combination of real instruments and MIDI instruments so that in a way you just don't know anymore what's what. And one of the things that I love is layering. So for the beat in this particular example, like that there are three things. There's like MIDI drums or sample drums. And then there's cajon that I play.
Oh, wow.
And then there's, I have like a patch of the bass, percussive bass that I've done. So there's like the equivalent of a kick drum, of a slap that is like a, more like a snare drum.
Yeah.
So I have it all in one in this program Battery that I used. It's like a drum machine. So I can trigger that my bass that I've sampled myself and make it part of a beat. So it makes this kind of weird thing.
But you have to create all of these different modular versions of the music so that the music editor for the podcast itself can insert different versions, different visions of your sound.
That's right.
Depending on the moment and the need.
So I make what it's called stems. And the stems are not the tracks, but like I will make a stem that's called guitars. So I will, that track itself needs to sound like its own little composition, horizontally, meaning like you can just play it back from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
And then it's cut in sections that can be loopable by a producer, just can get that little box, that little, little block, and just loop it over and over again. So you have this modular approach vertically and also horizontally. So there's really, I mean, many, many possibilities of how a piece can go. And I, as a composer, I have to think about it in this modular sense.
Yeah.
Not so much think this is my piece and that's it.
And you're never quite sure exactly how they're going to use it. So you give them all the raw materials.
That's right.
To create their episodes.
Yeah. And sometimes I listen to podcasts and I'm like disappointed. Oh, they really didn't use that. And I worked like for a couple of days on that guitar track. But oh, well. You know,
but so, like in the case of the slowdown, they always use the same intro and it's basically always the same length. Yeah. Is that unusual?
Yeah, I don't know. They've never used the stems and they were very adamant about the stems, but they didn't want to use them and maybe they'll use them at some point.
Well, but the ending of the episode is different music.
Right. Because there's two tracks. There's, there's like theme number one and theme number two, and theme number one was like more upbeat and theme number two was more reflective, pensive.
But it feels like theme number two has a lot to do with theme number one.
Yes.
Like, I've listened to a lot of these episodes because I love them. And I always have the feeling like, oh, this is some sort of variation on, like it doesn't feel like there was a break.
Yeah.
And now we're hearing this new.
Yeah. You could actually play both back and forth. I did it so that you could combine any of the parts of the two together as well.
Let me play a little bit of the, I guess, shall we call it the slowdown theme too? So that's the out sequence for slow down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're playing all the instruments except the horns.
That's right.
And you said you often record your acoustic piano, but in this case, it's a sampled Fender Rhodes probably somewhere. And you just got a marimba, you said?
Yeah. I mean, I use a lot of samples and samples are amazing today because like basically somebody going to a super high-end studio and sampling every note.
Mm.
Even like sometimes it's the same notes that they strike a number of times and they go through like this round robin kind of programming thing so that it feels real, you know what I mean? So it's crazy the amount of, I mean, I've experimented a little bit with sampling and it's a trip, you know, I do very, very basic stuff, but yeah, I like, you know, if I am playing it in real time, it doesn't really feel that it's different. And I've learned a lot about quantizing and what quantizing does and how does it feel when you quantize too much, too little, if you randomize. So
So for anybody who doesn't know what quantizing is,
when you are recording, you're recording to a click, to a metronome.
Right.
And then in the computer, you have basically a grid that can go very small or very large.
It's like the subdivisions of one beat.
Right. of one bar, of one beat, of eight bars or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there's a very famous DJ producer called Jay Dilla, mm-hmm. who sampled a lot of vinyl and put it into an MPC, which is an old Akai sampler. And then he would produce new music based on what he had sampled from vinyl. And it's like this mix and match collages, audio collages. And his vibe was like he would never quantize
it. It was unquantized.
That's
so
right.
There were different subdivisions going on
right.
at the same time.
It's just out of human feel.
Right.
Even though the source, so it's just like basically you pressing a button yeah. in real time.
Yeah. Yeah, which depending on who it is,
right.
could be very regular or very irregular.
Right. And sometimes I feel like it's too irregular. Then I just go in the microscope and I just move it by hand. I tweak it until it feels right.
Right.
It's weird. It's just...
Well, especially in podcast land, what we're talking about, you know, producing yeah. these kind of episodic, modular pieces, you know, that becomes really important.
Right.
And there's one other podcast that you sent over called Fiasco, which
right.
I haven't heard, and I want to ask you more about it, but we'll do that in the extras. But just... The funny thing that you told me about this when you sent me the music was that they asked for a mixture of Buena Vista Social Club and Miami Vice.
Yeah, exactly right. So do a song that starts like Buena Vista Social Club and ends like Miami Vice. Like, okay, can do. Because that's actually great. It's a great, it's like the old, you know, Stravinsky kind of quote, like the more limitations you have, the more freedom you have.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I'll take that challenge and I will actually make it work somewhat.
But then I would be like, okay, Miami Vice, which episode?
Well, the theme music, right?
I guess.
The episode with Miles Davis.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's season two or something like that.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine was pointing out that out the other day. I have to watch it again. It's so... Miles was pissed though because he was portrayed as a pimp and then he didn't like that.
Sort of a pimp and a drug
yeah,
dealer.
Drug
yeah,
dealer or something. Yeah. yeah. Which... Anyway.
Anyway, nothing to do with this, but this is what you wrote. So that's the music from Fiasco, the podcast, which is like an investigation type
right.
show. And this is like a something about the 2000 election in the
right.
United States.
Right.
So you told me that They asked you for Buena Vista Social Club and Miami Vice. And while we were listening, you said I had to redo the Buena Vista Social Club part 4 times.
Yes. So this is interesting. Like my kind of like business relationship with the producer is also like I limit the amount of times that I can redo things, but I also ask a lot of information from them. Mm-hmm. So I think I have like a Google Doc that's like 16 pages or something like that of like previous meetings and information. I ask a lot of references. Yeah. What would you like to hear? How would you like to hear? What's the vibe, right?
It makes your job easier.
Well, yeah, because
you get a specific direction.
Right, the more direction, the better. And to me, it's all, I mean, this applies to like everything I do musically. It's all about the vibe, the feel, the emotion. Like no matter how much technique or craft goes into it, it's just you press play or you are playing that music and it has a thing. It has you have like an immediate connection to that music. I mean, that's like my golden rule. I think most of our golden rule for you know.
Well, in this case, what was the thing that they weren't connecting?
So they gave me a bunch of different references and some of them were more like funk, modern-ish kind of like Latin funk or whatever. So my first version of this was like this kind of like Santana-esque backbeat groove with horns and the syncopated horns. And they're like, no, this is too much.
Oh.
The second version was maybe like a toned down version of that. And it's like, okay, no horns. So the third version was like an acoustic guitar, like nylon guitar and like the vibraphone, more faithful to Buena Vista Social Club. Mm-hmm. But he didn't like the harmony. He's like, I need like darker harmony because it has like, it's a pretty ominous thing. And I ended up like using all these like minor chords with like sharp 11 or whatever. So like, you know, and that was like really kind of dark-ish and then finally nailed it. But I kind of gave him a couple extra redos because there were other tracks that I did that were good at the first.
Oh, I see.
At the first day.
Interesting.
So,
but you had to lose the trumpets, sadly enough.
Yeah, they were MIDI trumpets, though. Oh, so okay. In that case, they didn't have. I mean, maybe we would have done real horns if it was approved, you know.
Yeah.
So, but the demo part was never even. They didn't even go through the next.
Do you ever have a case like? Okay, all these references and ideas, and they tell you what they want and what one to sound like, and what you know, it might connotations and whatnot. But do they ever send you someone reading the actual text? So you have the thing that you're going to be underscoring.
That's right. Yeah, I always ask for the voice, and even if it's not the same podcast, like I ask for a couple of minutes of the host.
To hear the person's voice and figure out how to.
It needs to be, the music needs to dress that voice. Hmm. And I mix it and I write it and I periodically check, how does this sound with the voice? Hmm. Sometimes you play a weird chord or something that doesn't go well frequency-wise with that voice. I don't know why, but I know it doesn't work.
Right.
So,
well, you have developed a good sense of that and obviously
I guess
really works.
I guess it's more like, it's really kind of like a more intuitive process in that regard. But I mean, I'm also very not kind of like self-conscious about it. It doesn't work. Move on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, that's thinking like a musician. And I mean, all of this comes out of your career, you know, producing your own music albums.
I guess, yes.
And making music that way. So I would imagine that in the other sense, all of this work that you're doing is feeding back into, you know, your own albums and production qualities that you're working on your new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I still continue to do my regular creative work, you know, like the last project that I did was like a live film score for like an old silent film, and I had a 7-piece band. It's like with trumpet, cello, voice, sort of like a chamber-esque thing, but a lot of improvisation as well, but we were also locked to the film. Yeah. With a track, you know, in our ears, this whole other level. Yeah. But it really makes me hear, having gone through this, all this sort of like production stuff, makes me hear my creative music a different way. And it's wired my brain in a different way as well. So it kind of all feeds into this kind of like, we're always learning more. And I always feel like I feel like a more complete musician without taking away from all the things that need to be completed, which are endless, you know, but It really makes me feel that I have more awareness of music in a way, in a strange way. I don't know exactly how.
But you have this project called Alorca Soundscape.
Right.
Is that, that's not the one you're talking about with the film.
No, that was the 2012-13. Yeah. And that was, I took music, poetry from this famous book from Federico Garcia Lorca. I was like...
I think that that's what you were writing when we met. Back in that workshop period.
I think I was writing more like the Poetica. Beginning. I was about to write Poetica stuff.
Right.
Actually,
so this is after.
8 bars that I wrote in that workshop ended up in a tune.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Happy to hear it. But I guess I came to this Lorca piece just because it feels like it synthesizes, you know, what you were saying about flamenco and new music.
Right.
And maybe jazz too,
right?
But and then it also brings in your production world,
right? Definitely, yes. I mean, this was tracked live in the studio with the band. Mm-hmm. We did this record in one day.
Yeah,
like I think there's like 8 songs or something. And incredible musicians, you know, it's Claudia Cunha and Miguel Zenon and Dan Tepfer. Mark Ferber.
You're going to get first takes from all of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think we did 2 takes. Maybe we did an insert here or there. It's like done. And then I did all these crazy overdubs with a lot of voices. I put a lot of voices myself, singing and the choirs, percussion, hand claps. I had Gilmar Gomez is like an incredible, I'm not sure. Incredible Brazilian percussionist doing djembe and all kinds of stuff. So I spent, I produced this with my friend Leo Sidran at his, Ben Sidran's son, at his studio. And before I had, this is a few years before I could actually do this at home. And it was great. I mean, it's like, I think there's like 80 tracks in this song.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of Danza de la Muerte. Danza de la Muerte from a Lorca soundscape. You had said something to me about having a sort of an aha moment listening to flamenco and catching a connection to American new music.
Right.
Like Steve Reich and Philip Glass and people from this period.
Right. I always loved that music for some reason. Like, let's call whatever minimalism or whatever. I don't really know if that is what it is. I love the music for airports, which coincidentally was improvised, right? Mm-hmm. And then scored, and then people replicate that improvisation in concert halls.
Yeah.
I love like Terry Riley's In C. All that kind of music for some reason spoke to me. And you know, also I went through a period where I suddenly started listening to a lot of flamenco, especially Paco de Lucía, Camarón, and it just, I saw the connection of like, in a way, for example, jazz is very cyclical music, that the traditional, you know, jazz standard, you have the melody, maybe the verse, if you're lucky, the melody, and then we repeat that over and over again, mm-hmm. until we play the melody at the end, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And both flamenco music and new music have this more linear, going in a forward direction. Hmm. So things are repeated, they're cyclical, but they evolve in a way that you're suddenly you're like five steps ahead of where you were before, but you didn't realize that you were there. And I saw a connection between the flamenco doing that. It's like a flamenco piece won't repeat a section. Mm. They'll have like what they call a falsetta, which is with like eight bars or something. And then there's a singing part. And then there's, I mean, they will have a structure in traditional parts, but in more modern flamenco, like Paco's albums or whatnot, yeah. it's completely linear. Mm-hmm. Something starts and evolves and ends in a different way that it started. So I was really attracted to that. And then I made a connection with doing like, the new music, which also had that element, the flamenco music, and where flamenco music comes from, the gypsy diaspora from India. Mm-hmm. There's a movie called Lacho Drum. Mm-hmm. It's a famous movie. I think the filmmaker's name is Tony Gatliffe, and mm-hmm. he's a gypsy French filmmaker. And it's an incredible film that has musical settings from India to Andalusia.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you can see it. You can see the evolution there. Then, you know, a lot of African music, like gamelan music, or gamelan is not from Africa, but like a lot of African music. I used to play with Anjali Kidjo, for example, incredible pop African singer, songwriter. And she played some rhythms that were like, I was like, this is like this flamenco rhythm. And I would play this to her. She'd be like, oh shit, I used to listen to this in my village when I was little, wow. you know. Hmm. So this rhythm, tanguillos, which is Danza de la Muerte,
yeah.
is based on tanguillos, which is like a rhythm from Cádiz, which is a hybrid between like 12-8 and 4-4.
Right.
It's like really in between.
It is a sort of clave, a flamenco clave in a way.
In
right?
a way, it's yes.
these underlying rhythmic pulses
yes.
that may be it's 10 to 12 beats long.
Right. It's very, but this one does not have the 12 beat clave. This is uh-huh. just like cycles, but it's very polyrhythmic in the sense that you have a triplet feeling and a straight uh-huh. feeling together.
Mm, I see.
So it's like a three against two and against four all mm-hmm. the time. Mm. So, My point being, like, it all coalesced. I saw these relationships at the intellectual level, but it took me a long time to like process them and work on them and try to understand them, sort of like both technically, intellectually, and then emotionally, to be able to put it into music that could be just performed or.
And do you feel like your new productions are all about that connection?
I mean, it's part of the element. Interestingly, I'm reading a book right now about brain development for children because I have children and uh-huh. I'm interested in that kind of stuff. And the author talks about implicit memory and explicit memory. Implicit memory being something that it's instinctive or part of you, mm-hmm. and explicit memory when you can rationalize what's going on, right? So I think in music, the process is the opposite. So in life, you have an impulse or an emotion and you are questioning, why did I do that? You know, why does a your baby crying make you cringe? You know, and then how do you process that emotion? I think in music, my process has been the opposite. I started from the intellectual level, and I've tried to make it into my intuitive level, into my instinctive level, in which like things happen in that way, but they happen because there's this sort of like rationalization process before. If that makes any sense. So I don't think about it right now. If I hear something that goes towards the flamenco thing, that element is there.
Right.
And I'm just going to make it happen. And it doesn't matter anymore where it came from.
Right. And maybe the thing is, to the way to think about it is, you know, figure out where it came from later.
Right.
In retrospect, like all of these thoughts that you're sharing now, you probably weren't aware of them at that time either.
Right. There's one of your albums, which, forgive me, I forget the name, that has a lot to do with 12-tone music. Mm. It's a quartet album, I think, with no mm-hmm. music. And I think that I read
no chord instrument.
No chord instrument.
Maybe Leap of Faith or
maybe
Magic Triangle. Or
I think it's like maybe Magic Triangle. And I think they use a lot of 12-tone techniques in that album, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So, I love like Warren's book and that kind of stuff, and like that it's like it's a tool, right? Like you eventually work with that tool to make something that is you, that speaks to yourself. As I mean, like when we talk about finding a voice, I mean, I don't really. Sometimes it sounds pretentious, I think, but to me, it's just like a very simple act of self-expression. This is like I feel comfortable saying this. And I feel an emotion saying this. And I think that one of the rewarding parts of like listening to your own performances, like when you go into the studio and you, after some time you press play and you have, you if you can be at peace with what you're hearing and you can be, that this is the emotion that I was trying to express. It's just like the very basic artistic expression that really comes from like 30,000 years ago when we were playing a flute in a cave, you know?
That's a beautiful thought. Yeah. You sent me some dance music that you're working on now.
Right.
It's a collaboration with a Hungarian choreographer.
That's right. Her name is Kata Juhász.
Uh-huh. Let's hear just a little bit of this.
Okay.
So I would imagine that's like one of the cues of the music that you developed with processed acoustic bass and electronics and it is the overall piece called Declaration of Independence?
Her piece, so what we're doing is like she wrote, we're doing it a little bit backwards because generally when you collaborate with film, well, for film I think it's more like you work with a locked picture. With dance, a lot of dancers work with a score that is done, or they commission a score and then there's a collaboration while both pieces are happening at the same time. Here it's the opposite. Like she had this piece. She actually discovered my music through a YouTube video, which is crazy.
Wow.
And then she contacted me. He's like, hey, can I use this music? And
I knew YouTube was good for something.
Yeah. I mean, we can go into this later.
Let's not.
But for whatever reason, this film score I did of Chaplin, the Immigrant, which was commissioned by the New School, like has 1+ million views. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of, it's reached a lot of people. It's great. And Kata reached out to me. I love this music. Can I use it for my piece? And then it's like, you know, let's talk on the phone. Just kind of tried to gauge where she's coming from. And we just hit it off. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, use it. If you ever get some money from, she was waiting for a grant or whatever, right. Just give me the money and great, no problem. So a few months after, she calls me. It's like, hey, I got the money. I got this much money. And she's like, but what do you think about collaborating in something else? And I'm like, well, since that other music I licensed to you, it's already done. How about you give me this money? We'll say it's for that music, but I'll write something new for you for whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And then she was working on this piece. And
you know that this podcast is public, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So?
Well, somebody might hear that you told them that the... Anyway.
It's no, fine. But it's all my music, so yeah. it's all good.
I'm sort of half joking, but at the same time.
It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm transparent. I have nothing to hide.
Right.
We are watched by Big Brother all the time, anyway. So I do have a tape I have a Band-Aid actually on my laptop camera.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's just in case.
Well, okay. Well, if Kata and her funders come looking for you, then I hope that my podcast is not the problem.
No. Anyway, so. It's been a great process. Then she was in a residency in Philadelphia last fall, and she came to see the premiere of my new work in Washington, the Shoes film score. We met there in person for the first time. Then she came to New York. We went to a dance studio and improvised for 2 days.
Great.
And then she showed me the piece. Like it's a monologue. It's a solo piece, and she's dancing to nothing. So she's like, do something that you think goes well with that. So we've been working on videos. She's been videoing. I've been doing music. And then I use it I put it together on Premiere. So I put music on what she's already danced, which is the opposite of what you normally do. Mm-hmm. So I write music that does not necessarily match the beats or whatever, but it's all very kind of abstract.
That's great.
And then now she's changing the choreography, given
based
the music
on what
that
you wrote.
So we are still working on it, and also it's loop based in a way. So she's gonna put it into this software called QLab, and she's gonna extend some of the pieces, fade out some of the pieces. She has a guy there working on it. So it's a very improvisational piece.
That sounds like a great process.
Yeah.
And it's also facilitated by, you know, digital tools and the internet and communications.
Yeah. Yeah, we talk on WhatsApp and have a Dropbox, and we share everything there, and we go back and forth, and we hope to be done by the end of July.
Because
the official premiere is in November.
Is so that I hope, in Hungary? In Budapest.
Yeah, I hope to go because I was there last November as well. Yeah. And we were working for a couple of days, and it's great. I mean, I definitely have enjoyed the process, and the whole point of doing it with a bass is also kind of like, this is no MIDI, everything comes from my instrument in my own terms.
Do you still travel with your bass?
No, I never travel with my bass.
So you would play a rented instrument over there?
No, because I don't play the bass on the thing. I record the bass at home.
Oh, I see. So you're manipulating things that you've already tracked.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. So are you also working on a new record? I would imagine the next thing is in the pipeline for Alexis Cuadrado.
I'm not sure about making records per se. So I'm in conflict with that concept at the moment, personally. I definitely want to record the Shoes film score that I did, perhaps The Immigrant. And I want to do that either later this year or earlier next year.
And how would you release it then, if not?
Because they're both tied to a film.
Oh.
I may want to release the film digitally.
Yeah.
I also don't think a lot of people are using DVDs anymore.
Right.
So I'm actually working with the distributor of one of the films, and they've been really gracious.
Some kind of a digital distribution system.
Yeah. I mean, this film is out. The Shoes film is out.
Yeah.
And the people who actually own the rights to the film are like a really cool... Milestone Films, they're a really cool mom and pop's company. They're a married couple that their passion is silent film, and they go to crazy archives and stuff and restore this film.
That's great.
So they own the rights to the restoration, which is the film that I'm working on.
Oh, I see.
And we have a deal, And we're working something out, and I hope that I can make something work with them.
Wow. Yeah. And this record that you made with Antonio Lizana.
Yeah, this is just one song so far.
Oh, I see.
And hope that it'll be more. And he is a mind-blowing artist.
Yeah.
Blows my mind. He's
I want to play some of this on our way out
from
the show. But it's
this is actually for a film. And it's a documentary film about a friend of his that got wrongly convicted for something. And he's in jail right now. So there is a flamenco palo. A palo is a song style called carcelera, which is the story of someone who's in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so Antonio's here for a couple months at the beginning of the year. And we played a few gigs. He's an incredible flamenco singer and an incredible jazz saxophonist all in one.
And so he's doing both things on this track.
Yes. Yes. Wow. So he's, and then, you know, we talked and it's like, hey, you know, why don't we just come home and let's just do something. Think about something that you would like to do just for fun and see what happens. So he came and said, you know, I have this idea about this movie that they asked me to do. Why don't we do that?
Mm.
So a lot of what we hear in the track are actually beats that I had already programmed. It's like percussion with the bass.
Mm-hmm.
And I programmed this crazy drone-ish kind of sound with 12 fed back guitars at home.
Mm-hmm.
Detuned to E-flat and all this crazy stuff. So I spent a day doing that patch just for another project.
Wow.
So I recycled a lot of material that I had from this other project that was about Syria and Syrian music and stuff. Hmm. And we did a combination of that sort of like Maxum beat, which is like a Middle Eastern beat, with a Seguirilla Martinete, which is like one of the 12 beat things. So it's
nice.
This whole collage hodgepodge of things.
That's a beautiful piece.
Thank you. But we actually worked on it together. We produced it together. We had like four different versions of the form of the song,
mm-hmm.
longer, shorter, more solos, less solos. And we worked on it for 2 days.
Wow. Well, I hope I know you don't like records anymore, but I hope
I do like them. I love them. I have hundreds of CDs and I have LPs at home. I love that.
Well, thanks for talking with me. This is fantastic.
You.
Thanks for all the music.
Oh, man.
Incredible.
Such an honor to be here.
I'll be listening not just to the podcast music, but also for these new projects as they come out.
Thanks, man. I appreciate
it. And this, you know, digital video with music idea, you know, please keep me up to date on it, because that is super interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sure for everybody that listens to this too would want to hear about that. So thanks so much. So we will go out with that tune. Are you using the theta, or do you say carcelera?
You can do carcelera or carcelera.
Carcelera.
Whichever you like.
Ay, el eco de